Welcome and thank you for joining us for another episode of KPMG's Inside International Tax, a podcast devoted to recent developments, observations, and trends related to U.S. international tax. I'm one of your hosts, Gary Scanlon, a principal in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice, and I'm joined by my co-host yet again, Kristen Gamboa, a managing director in the same group. Say hi, Kristen.
Hey, Gary.
Today, we're excited to be joined by Doug O'Donnell, a former acting IRS commissioner among many other roles at the IRS. Doug has recently joined KPMG as co-leader of our WNT Tax Controversy and Dispute Resolution Group. Welcome to the podcast, Doug.
Thanks, Gary. Happy to be here.
We're thrilled to have you on this podcast. I gave you a very brief introduction, which is entirely insufficient given the nearly four decades you spent at the IRS, culminating in its highest position. Could you give us a more thorough recount of your background and some of the key roles you filled during your time at the IRS?
Yeah, happy to. And that's something I've been doing quite a bit of since I joined KPMG. I started off in 1986 as a revenue agent, so I think everyone's familiar with that, but out there conducting audits. I held a series of different domestic roles. I became an executive at the IRS in 2003. And in 2007, I went over to international. It was a fairly significant shift for me going from a field role domestic to an international role. And the first work I got put on in international was dealing with offshore accounts that high wealth individuals, U.S. persons had abroad, primarily in Switzerland and Liechtenstein. And I was immediately working in a multilateral group with the UK, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, trying to understand how to approach this compliance issue that we had. And then in the US, I was coordinating Department of Justice and colleagues in the IRS Criminal Investigation Division. And so I was immediately thrust into a really interesting environment. Then I moved quickly into a much more multilateral setting, supporting the IRS commissioner and this forum on tax administration, which is a group of about 50 commissioners that's part of the OECD, and they focus only on tax administration issues. So they stay away from the policy and focus on those issues that are relevant to them in running their tax administrations around the world. There's a number of projects that I got involved in there, leadership projects along the way, very interesting. A couple that I'll mention, when Doug Shulman was the commissioner at the IRS, I led the development of an assembly of a joint audit process guide. I worked on developing the International Compliance Assurance Program, and I chaired the Mutual Agreement Forum. And I know we'll get into a couple of these in a bit more detail, but I think it's just useful to understand that in a handful of years, I was in the midst of a lot of different things that were going on in this space internationally. In 2014, I became the Deputy Commissioner International. And in that role, and in the LB&I commissioner role, which followed a year later, I held the two of those, deputy for 1 year, commissioner for six. I was the United States competent authority. And in that role, I was responsible for treaty administration for the entire U.S. tax treaty network. So that's dealing with exchange of information, mutual agreement procedure, and a whole host of other interpretive issues that we dealt with. And then following the large business commissioner role, I went into the deputy commissioner of the IRS role. It's the senior most civilian role that is not confirmed at the IRS, not Senate confirmed. And I was in that role for almost 4 years, and I got to act twice as the IRS commissioner, once in November 2022, and again in January 2025. The 2022 acting assignment was 4 months long. The 2025 was closer to 6 weeks.
Well, Doug, that's really impressive. You put me to shame. I know you just joined the firm and you probably haven't even figured out where the bathrooms are, but what have you come to KPMG to do? What's your role here?
Well, when you read off the part of Washington National Tax that I'm in, tax controversy and dispute resolution, it's really about helping clients in both the dispute prevention space and, to the extent that disputes do occur, resolving them as quickly as possible. And in doing this both in a domestic and a global setting. And so when you think about some of the issues that we have available to us by working with the IRS that are pre-filing, there's a pre-filing agreement, which is typically focused on a transaction that has occurred where the law is pretty settled. There's an industry issue resolution, which is something that's used less frequently, but it's an opportunity to work with taxpayer groups that are running into challenges where published guidance could solve it. And so it's a concerted effort to work through a challenge and come up with a solution that then can be part of, for example, a revenue procedure or a rev ruling or something along those lines. It's usually a lighter piece of published guidance, but something that gives clarity and certainty on how to move forward. Two more in the pre-file space. One, compliance assurance program, which the IRS developed and rolled out in 2004, 2005. And it's basically an attempt to resolve all material items affecting the federal income tax liability by the time that a tax return is filed. So it's a bit of a pre-file real-time audit process. It's a great opportunity where there's not too much complexity in terms of factually intensive issues that require a ton of development. Again, resolving all the issues by the time a return is filed is pretty impressive, and they're for large corporate taxpayers. The final one in the international space is the advanced pricing agreements, which allow for a taxpayer to come into the competent authorities and resolve in advance the pricing for cross-border transactions. It's a very effective tool. It's been in place for a number of years. A lot of large taxpayers take advantage of that program. It's one that we really like to use to settle issues where it's likely that there's going to be some sort of controversy. And in the post-file space, there's a number of different tools that are available. I'll mention a couple. Fast Track Settlement, it's an appeals program. There's also early referral to appeals. And these programs are intended to help resolve in an informal setting disputes that have arisen. And those disputes could be purely domestic, could be cross-border, just depends on what one has. It's a good idea to be speaking with your consultants and those who have expertise in the different program areas to sort out what it is that is the best way to go forward. One other thing I'd be working on with clients is understanding the big picture risk environment in which they're operating, and trying to understand how best to position, what posture to take, given the different countries that one may be interacting with.
Doug, we've talked a lot about the OECD, in particular BEPS 2.0. I understand that you were involved in BEPS 1.0 while at the IRS. What did you work on there, and what, if anything, came out of that work?
So the policy work was done largely by the Treasury Department, and we were largely charged with implementing the outcomes of the BEPS 1.0 work. And the ones that affected us most at the IRS were actions 5, 13, and 14. 5 was harmful rulings, which required certain rulings to be exchanged with treaty partners. 13, which is one that introduced new type of information reporting to help with transfer pricing and permanent establishment risk assessment. And this resulted in the country-by-country reporting, which has been the subject of a lot of discussion and debate. And finally, Action 14, which was focused on improving dispute prevention and dispute resolution mechanisms. And so there was a real nod here to business saying, you're introducing all these new complicated rules. What are you going to do to help solve them? In Action 13, what we did, in addition to having to put into place a whole filing apparatus for new information reporting and the ability to exchange that with treaty partners, we work closely with a number of other jurisdictions led by the Canadian Revenue Agency. This is under the formal tax administration. So that group of 50 plus commissioners I mentioned earlier, to develop an effective use guide. And the reason for that is there were a lot of concerns being expressed by tax professionals, taxpayers around the world, that there were going to be tax administrations who were just going to take the information without conducting a full functional analysis of a company or its transactions and just propose adjustments based on the sort of reporting that was coming in. So we were very concerned by those comments and worked hard to put together an effective use guide, which I think has largely been successful. That was something that was worked on early on in the 2015-2016 period. So finally, on Action 14, the focus there, again, this is one that was a business-friendly outcome. It may be the only part of BEPS 1.0 that was considered business friendly, was to put in writing the expectation that tax administrations around the world would have implemented and maintained a strong dispute resolution program with a nod to trying to have more dispute prevention. And that was largely thought to be advanced pricing agreements, but that did not get as much traction as certainly the IRS had hoped. But in total, a lot of really good was done to develop that report, which led into a subsequent effort, which I know we'll get into in more detail as we move forward.
So maybe I know the answer to this question already, but of the BEPS actions that you were involved in, what do you think made the most significant impact and or are you the most proud of?
Yeah, I'd say that Action 14 is the one that, in my view, we were able to make the biggest impact on and the one I'm most proud of being involved in. We knew and know that the MAP function is an important dispute resolution mechanism. It is the way that competent authorities are authorized under their treaty network to resolve these issues. But the whole process was considered to be a bit of a black box. A lot of tax professionals and taxpayers like not really sure what goes on. They may understand the process, but not how it's actually going. And there was a significant effort undertaken to create two separate, I'll say, reporting regimes that were intended to bring light upon what was going on in the MAP functions around the world. The first one was a peer review process, which was a deep look at each member's MAP function to understand how it compared to the framework that was in existence. So whether taxpayers can gain access to the program, whether they were being properly considered, whether cases were being resolved, and any change that was being made or agreed to in negotiations was actually implemented in accordance with the mutual agreement. The other part of it was statistical reporting, and this is one that a number of members of the inclusive framework really pushed on, because we knew that the peer review process would be helpful, but that was going to be sort of multi-year effort for reporting to come out for each of the countries. But the statistical reporting was something that was an annual report that reflected how a country was doing in terms of its overall inventory, but also how it was doing in a country paired illustration of data. And the point here was that you could see how, for example, the United States was doing with its inventory overall, but more interesting and helpful for businesses that were considering investing in a jurisdiction, if they wanted to understand what the MAP function was like between the US and another country, you know, UK, India, Canada, Mexico, wherever you wanted to look, you could go in and review specific country pair reports. That effort, especially the statistical reporting effort, was a significant challenge in that a lot of countries were concerned about how much of a light this would shine on their inventory and the management of the same. But a number of the members of the inclusive framework were like, yes, it will, but it's important because we all need to be working in the same direction to try to improve this process to be able to solve these problems. And so got a lot of help from a lot of different parties. I'll say that in the US, at the time, it was Commissioner John Koskinen at the IRS. He was a huge proponent of what he called, you know, put sunshine into the process. And he really helped us get that whole package across the goal line to complete that effort.
So it sounds like you're pretty passionate about the MAP process and the work that you did with the MAP Forum. Can you give us a high-level overview of what MAP is and why a taxpayer might seek MAP?
MAP is a highly effective tool where the United States government works with foreign counterparts to agree on the allocation of the taxing rights for particular items that are covered in our respective treaties and work to resolve in accordance with what the treaty provides for in a manner that is principled from the perspective of both or multiple competent authorities if there's more than two that are involved.
That's helpful. So what does the MAP process look like and how long does it usually take?
So the MAP process is one where the taxpayer that is a subject to the double tax, for example, files an application with their competent authority. They can actually file with both competent authorities. It's wise to do so to the extent that that's permitted under the treaties to alert the competent authority that there is an adjustment that is resulting in double tax. The two governments then exchange position papers and engage in a series of negotiations. It is possible that a case can be resolved based on a letter written to the other competent authority asking for an adjustment to be withdrawn. That sometimes works. Frequently, in the majority of the cases, there needs to be a negotiation, some sort of a discussion. Typically in the past, they were all handled in person. The two countries would take turns traveling to one another's country. It's typically in the national capital, but not always. And they would work through an inventory of cases to agree on what the appropriate taxation would be. Those cases can take anywhere from 2 to 3 years or longer, depending on how complicated they are. The goal in the Action 14 report is 24 months. Transfer pricing cases currently, looking across the volume across all the countries, is closer to 32 months for transfer pricing cases and a bit under 24 months. It's about 23 and a quarter for the other cases that are being worked. And I think it's important to note that a fairly high percentage of these cases worldwide are resolved in a manner where the taxpayer does not end up paying tax twice. There's either a complete elimination of the adjustment or an agreement that if the income is going to remain increased in one jurisdiction, that there would be a correlative reduction in the other jurisdiction so that that original 100 of income, if there was an adjustment in one country to make it 50 more, you can't have 150 of income when there was only 100. And so those competent authorities are expected to resolve that so that there's only $100 being taxed in the two jurisdictions. And so the effort is to either eliminate it or to give relief if you cannot completely eliminate that adjustment.
Can the U.S. pursue MAP with any country? And are there differences in how other countries interact with the U.S.?
The United States can only pursue MAP where there is an existing tax treaty that provides for the mutual agreement procedure. It's typically one of the articles that is included. It's in our model. It's in the OECD model, so you typically do see it. But if there is no tax treaty, there cannot be a MAP. So, for example, if there is a tax information exchange agreement that only provides for tax information exchange, that does not provide for the mutual agreement procedure. It is correct to presume that there are differences in interacting with the different competent authorities around the world. There's a lot of things that one needs to take into account when meeting with a foreign competent authority. One is cultural, and keeping in mind that when one is traveling to another jurisdiction, there are cultural norms that we should be aware of, whether we're part of the government or not. At the IRS, there was an effort undertaken to train in cultural awareness just so that there was a sort of a baseline understanding that when you leave the United States to travel to name the jurisdiction, there can be a lot of differences in the way that you're expected to conduct yourself. Your comportment is really important. Language can be a challenge in some places. There is, for example, a fairly common practice between the U.S. and Japan, and I suspect there could be other countries where it's the same, that there will be interpreters so that both countries can speak in their native language, which is really important when trying to work through some of the complicated factual scenarios that exist in cases that some competent authorities have less flexibility in overturning adjustments that their field has proposed. That's actually been the subject of discussions in the MAP forum. There is an expectation that a competent authority has full authority to resolve all matters, but there are instances where they are a bit hamstrung in how far they can go. And so it's important to know what that looks like going in. And the final point would be that not every competent authority has the same view of what the treaty articles say and mean. And it's really important for the United States competent authority and for taxpayers that are taking advantage of the MAP, that they appreciate that there are differences there. And it can be useful to be talking to the United States competent authority or to your tax advisors who have experience in this area to get an understanding of what that may mean in terms of how you want to position yourself in terms of the information you're providing and what your expectations should be for resolving the issues.
So MAP seems like a great option to resolve double taxation, but does the MAP process guarantee that an agreement will be reached and that all double taxation will be eliminated? I guess just generally, how successful is MAP?
First off, I'll start by saying MAP is a great option. I mean, it is the way to resolve these issues. There is an obligation on the part of the treaty partners to undertake to solve these matters, but they're not obligated to provide relief. But I'll say that the U.S. and frankly, all the competent authorities, they do take this responsibility very seriously and do work to achieve an outcome where there is not double taxation. Roughly 90% of, by dollar volume, the cases that the United States competent authority has had have been successfully resolved. And that's in instances where there is not mandatory binding arbitration. There's a handful of U.S. treaties that do have that. I'll say one other thing about MAP that's really important, and it is the ongoing interaction of the competent authorities and building a mutual understanding of one another's programs and how they're thinking about issues. That can be super helpful in making sure that, for example, a field examiner in the U.S. is raising an issue, the United States competent authority could say, that adjustment that you're proposing is not going to be accepted by the foreign government, and you should really think about how you're approaching it. We may not even take that adjustment forward. And so there's a sort of global awareness aspect to the mutual agreement procedure that's sort of an ancillary benefit that you get by engaging in these ongoing negotiations that should not be forgotten by anyone, because it is a super important part of the process.
So if a taxpayer decides to pursue MAP, what helps to make MAP successful?
I would start with, as soon as a taxpayer becomes alert to a potential adjustment that is going to affect them in a double taxation manner, they should alert the U.S. competent authority. They should also make sure that they are aware of time limitations for filing. To the extent that this is something they're not familiar with, working with an experienced advisor is very helpful. Each treaty is different, and it's important to appreciate that and be talking to advisors to help understand it, but also the United States competent authority to make sure that they're doing whatever it is that needs to be done with the U.S. competent authority. And then a thorough application that provides all the relevant information regarding the adjustment, the facts, the documents that were provided. And finally, once the case is in the inventory and there are negotiations that are underway, it's really important to maintain an ongoing communication with the United States competent authority to just follow up, understand what's going on, but also to make oneself available to answer questions that may come up or provide additional information that could be useful in a negotiation. And this can be especially important in the midst of a negotiation. I saw this a number of times where it was very important to be able to reach back to taxpayer, tax professional. We're in this negotiation. We've run into this question. Our treaty partner has put this information out there. We're not aware of it. Can you confirm or clarify what this is or what it means? And it's super helpful because that could help resolve that case at that time, as opposed to having to wait for another round of negotiations, which could be months into the future. And so it's really important to stay attuned to what's going on and to be in a posture of supporting that effort going forward.
Doug, that's really interesting background because I know almost nothing about MAP until this episode. Are certain jurisdictions quicker in moving through the MAP process compared to others?
There are definitely variations in the speed at which cases do get resolved, and there are a variety of reasons for that. It could be that some are better staffed than others. Some have more experienced staff than others. The ATMA team at the IRS, that's the group that's responsible for the transfer pricing cases that come up in MAP. They are quite experienced. They're very effective at their jobs, and they work well with all the treaty partners. Some take longer than others. And I'll give an example of my experience while I was there. We ran into some difficulty with one jurisdiction where we could not resolve cases in a manner that we thought was consistent with the treaty. And we ended up having multiple rounds and then halting our activity with them. We were very public about it at the time. But that put a lot of taxpayers into this sort of holding pattern where for an extended period, year and a half or so, there was no ongoing discussion. Actually, it was longer than that. And it took some effort on the part of the United States competent authority to get to a place where we were comfortable that we could continue moving forward. And so it's very much about staff numbers, staff capability, and the posture that the two countries are taking and whether or not there are significant difficulties in resolving cases. And that can be the case where two countries have a challenge in a particular area. It is useful. Talked earlier about Action 14 and the statistical reporting. All that information is public. It can be found on the OECD.org site by just putting in 2023 Mutual Agreement Procedure Statistics. And there's a ton of information that you can see that gives insight into total inventories, types of cases in the inventory, time it takes to resolve cases. And there are definitely differences in how long it takes to resolve. I'll say that transfer pricing cases typically are the longest in duration. Cases that involve residency and that sort of thing. Questions around withholding can typically be resolved more quickly, but I will say that there are some instances where the underlying character of the income that's subject to the withholding turns into a much more complicated debate and argument, and those cases can also extend into the multi-year timeframe, which nobody likes, but the United States is not going to back off of a position where they are confident that this item that is being characterized as something subject to withholding is not in fact that, and they will work very hard to resolve those in a way that's consistent with the treaty.
Doug, there's been obviously a lot of reporting on IRS staff cuts recently. Do you anticipate any of these cuts to the IRS will affect the MAP process in the U.S.?
It's a fair question to ask at this point because there's a lot of moving parts at the IRS. What I'd start with is that, yes, there have been some losses of personnel in ATMA. It's not completely clear what the numbers are. The reporting is that they have not lost the 25 to 30% that other parts of the IRS have lost. It's also correct that LB&I, which is a division in which ATMA resides, is very much aware of the importance of maintaining the staffing in that program, making sure that there are qualified, capable people and numbers to manage inventory. And I wouldn't say it's ring-fenced, but there is a definite attempt to ensure that those personnel, to the extent possible, are kept in those roles. And to the extent that there are losses, that there is an effort made to rapidly replace them. And if they can't hire from the outside, they may be looking to reassign from other parts of the IRS, specifically in Large Business International, where the technical competence exists. They may not be familiar with working in the competent authority space where they're negotiating with another country, but they understand the subject matter such that they can come in and perform that work. So my expectation going forward is that there could be a dip in the number of people. I think over time it will stabilize in a manner that's consistent with the work. The U.S. does have one of the largest competent authority staffs in the world. There's a lot of activity outside of the United States, audit activity that causes the United States to have to be in these negotiations. To ensure that there is an appropriate type of taxation is super important going forward. And I expect that they'll continue to staff that program up.
Yeah, the U.S. is a very competent authority. Doug, do you have any practical advice to give taxpayers with a view towards MAP?
Yeah, I do. And I touched on this a little bit before, but it's really important to make contact with ATMA as early as possible when you become aware that there is an adjustment that is likely or being proposed that could give rise to double tax. This is a case whether it's in the United States or abroad. And the reason it's important to the U.S., and this may be surprising to some folks, but the U.S. competent authority can have a conversation with the field to tell them that that adjustment that you're proposing is not going to be accepted by the treaty partner. We are not going to take it forward. And they can get them to drop the adjustment in the U.S. before it's actually raised. If they're not successful, they can also just withdraw the adjustment when it gets to the U.S. competent authority. It's important to have those discussions early on so that U.S. competent authority is informed. And then once the adjustments are there and you know that you are now being double taxed, it is to file that application as quickly as possible. Maintain excellent records of what has happened and make sure that you have a robust, full application that addresses the issues that are giving rise to this double taxation. And stay involved in the process. Keep apprised of what's happening. Make sure you're following up, asking questions, providing input, and when there are negotiations underway, being available to provide any additional information or answer any questions that may come up. As I mentioned earlier, it could be that that could help resolve a case during the negotiation as opposed to having to wait for another cycle of negotiations.
So MAP seems like often a good option, but what are some other options a taxpayer can pursue to provide some certainty on their intercompany transactions?
a taxpayer in the U.S. can take advantage of appeals, which is the informal process within the IRS. They could litigate. Advanced pricing agreements are a great tool. It's an opportunity to resolve an issue in advance. It is called an advanced pricing agreement. The truth of the matter is the majority of them do happen. The term of an APA can be 5 years, could be longer, but typically five. And by the time the work is done and there's an agreement between the two competent authorities, it's typically somewhere in the middle of the full term. So it's not fully advanced. But one of the benefits is that you do get certainty, and you also have penalty protection, which can be very important if there is one or the other tax administration that maybe would propose a penalty on a transfer pricing adjustment. For example, ICAP is another option. It's an International Compliance Assurance Program. I alluded to it earlier. Basically, it's an opportunity for a taxpayer to work in a multilateral setting with a handful of tax administrations to assess the transfer pricing and permanent establishment risk. It is done using the Action 13 country-by-country reporting. And so it gives a taxpayer a pretty good line of sight into how the different tax administrations view their risk with respect to those two issues. I would add that it is important to think about how complicated your transfer pricing is. And there are some ways to evaluate that if one is considering it, to talk to an advisor who may have been involved in ICAP. There's not a lot of them, but there are some. It's also to review the user guide that is also public. There's a part of it that refers to the documentation package. And in that, it refers to a template that one has to complete. And that template requires a complete listing of all the transactions that a taxpayer has underway. And if when one starts working through that, if it's looking pretty complicated, or if you talk to somebody who has been through ICAP, they say, look, that's a bit more complicated than you're going to want to take forward. You probably don't want to go into the process. But there are a lot of taxpayers where this could be a great opportunity to resolve questions of risk around transfer pricing and PE to the extent where you would know, I don't need to do anything further because my risk is super low. Or one or two of the countries are worried about a particular transaction and I should work on an APA with them. Those outcomes can be very useful for taxpayers just to understand how other tax administrations view their risk.
Thank you, Doug, for joining us today and sharing your insights into the MAP process. And a special thank you to Kat Winslow and John Barron for their help behind the scenes with this episode. As always, please stay tuned for future episodes of KPMG's Inside International Tax to stay up to speed on the latest developments in U.S. international tax. Until our next episode, take care.